So yeah, welcome back to God and Beer. We've got a great lineup of speakers for 2024. And to kick it off, we're going to be hearing about Catholicism at the movies. So I guess the background for this talk is that I myself have a real passion for the movies. I love watching movies whenever I can. And last year I attended an event that our speaker, Jeremy Ambrose, ran. He does these regular screenings of classic movies, which are for the Melbourne Catholic Cinephiles community. And at the end, they do a discussion around the movie that everyone who's watched it sort of has a talk about it. And I was really, really impressed with the way Jeremy opened up the movie. We watched a great old classic movie called Bandwagon, which was a terrific film. Fred Astaire, it's got dancing, it's got songs, really good movie. But at the end, we had this discussion about it, which Jeremy led and facilitated. And after that discussion, I realised, well, this is a way better film than I realised. You know, he was able to help us to see lots of new dimensions to that movie that weren't obvious. So I think this is probably partly because Jeremy's studied theology. He's got a master's in theology from the University of Notre Dame. And so he's able to see the deeper themes in some of these films, the deeper messages. And he also brings that, I believe he does a great job bringing that to bear in his work at the Australian Catholic University Melbourne campus, where he's the pastoral associate for staff there, helping people connect with their faith and understand their faith better. He's got a real passion for the arts, which especially comes out in his love for movies, books, and Elvis Presley music. So I think he's going to sing a few songs for us later on. And then he's got his project, the Melbourne Catholic Cinephiles Group, which he'll mention later on. So that's just an introduction to tell you a little bit about Jeremy and our topic tonight, Catholicism at the movies.
Thank you, Pastor. So I want to start by asking you to imagine a world where Catholic filmmakers were amongst the most popular and most influential, where priests were always depicted as icons of goodness, where faith and prayer belonged as naturally to celluloid as they do to churches, and where all movies were supposed to responsibly contribute to the uplifting of culture and the protecting of decency. In fact, imagine that every movie in this world had to go through an office run by lay Catholics to ensure each film remained consistent with this moral universe, basically this moral universe shaped by their Catholic values. Can you imagine all of that? Wouldn't it be incredible? Now, the sad fact for us today is what I've just described is not a fantasy, but was the world of Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s. That was the reality. Catholicism was not only very present in the movies, but also Catholics had such vast influence in the making of movies. I'm just going to start my timer because I can tend to go on for a long time, so I'm going to make sure that I get you guys out of your time. So films had a clear sense of morality and the common good. Let's call this the golden age of movies. It was definitely golden for Catholics. And only in the mid-60s did everything change, leading to our world and cinema of today. So I'd like to take you briefly on a tour of this era, because I think it's worth appreciating and recognizing where Catholics did shape the culture and the unbelievable power we had for imparting truth, beauty, and goodness. And through this powerful medium of cinema. After this, I want to lead to the situation today, the things we can hope for, and the things we can already begin to celebrate. Now, you might want to know why I've been asked to speak about this tonight. John said that he attended an event, which I'm very happy that he attended, because I don't have a PhD in film. But I'd like to quote the great filmmaker Martin Scorsese, who said in an interview, "The two things most important in my life are God and movies." It's a line I would adopt for myself, and that will be why I'm here speaking to you tonight. movies and God, or faith and theology, have been the most important pillars of my life. Don't tell my wife that. Shaping me, forming me, obsessing me all the way through thus far. And often they've been intertwined in my experiences. My faith has led to a deeper reading of film, and film has inspired my faith. So let's start. Part one. The Catholic directors. What I'm about to say is a generalization, I know, but generalizations can only exist because there is some sort of truth in them, even if there are many examples that don't fit the mold exactly. So in the golden age of Hollywood, we had Jewish producers funding Catholic directors to make movies for Protestant audiences. Now, we know there were many Jewish and Protestant filmmakers too, and we know that Catholics and Jews also went to the movies. But my point in the generalization is so we can see what was a common pattern at the time, a framework for how things worked. Because the majority religion in USA was Protestantism, the majority of studio heads and producers were Jewish, and some of the greatest, most prolific and celebrated directors of all time were Catholic. Now, why Catholic directors? Why did Catholic directors stand out? I want to suggest three primary reasons for why Catholics got into the career of directing and why they eventually rose to the top, being the best of the best. Firstly, Catholics, a lot of them were immigrants. They were working class. But the movie industry was this brave new world where anyone could break in. There wasn't the Catholics need not apply signs as there were in so many other places. Instead, there were opportunities galore. So these working class immigrants found opportunities through the movie industry to express their creativity and their visual flair. Which brings me to my second point, their visual flair. Film is primarily a visual medium. And it took directors with creative visual flair and natural instincts for images and storytelling to stand out. I want to suggest that such things came naturally to Catholics, who grew up their whole lives surrounded by stunning visual depictions of their sacred story through stained glass windows, painting, statues, liturgical vestments, all the smells and bells that make up the theatrical experience of rich liturgy. The Stations of the Cross, the frescoes, the mosaics, the architecture, and the use of light and dark. Everything that I've mentioned prepared them for the world of film that they would eventually enter. Their experience of the sacraments especially matched up with the concept of cinema, what I would call the sacramentality of cinema. I mean, think about what cinema is. Visible images that reveal an invisible meaning. Think about the experience of cinema as a lot of us would have experienced, and some of you more than us, because it was the main form of entertainment. You didn't have devices, you didn't have a home system you could watch movies on. But the cinema experience was going to the movies together, going out and being an audience at the cinema. I mean, think about it in comparison to the Catholic Mass. At the Mass, people come together as one body to receive the sacrament and then to become what they have received. At the movies, people come together as one audience to receive sacramentally what was given, and that is those visible images that reveal an invisible meaning in the telling of a story, such that the audience starts to become what they have received. We all know that movies affect the culture. Movies form us. Why? Well, there's a sacramental quality about them. So Catholics were culturally trained in visual, sensual storytelling, and from birth they lived the sacramentality inherent to the medium. Now, my third reason for why Catholics were such successful directors was they knew about light and they knew about dark. Catholics knew about the dark, but they never lost sight of light. Films did not have to be all light without any other shades, nor did they have to be all darkness without any redemptive light. Catholics could take audiences into the heart of darkness, like the best artists and writers, but always leading back to the light. Alfred Hitchcock is a great example of this, perhaps in a more superficial way. But even his darkest thrillers contain streaks of humour and wit, communicating a kind of morbid joviality. Catholics also thought about and naturally connected with the most human of themes, themes deep within our own theology, themes of sin, guilt, confession, grace, redemption, and community. These are all deep in the Catholic psyche, and they make for the most interesting and most human of stories. So let's talk about some specific directors and highlight some of their most Catholic movies. Now look, originally I had like four examples from every director, and I realized this talk was going to go for 2 hours. So I've tried to cut it down, and I'm primarily only going to talk about one film in detail from each of these directors. Alfred Hitchcock. Hitchcock wasn't known for his religious background. Rather, he was known for being one of the most popular directors of his time. And at the time, he wasn't considered a great director, simply because his films were so popular, and the critics didn't think it was possible to have greatness and mass appeal rolled up together. Only in the 1960s, a group of French critics who would all go on to become famous filmmakers themselves shone the spotlight on Hitchcock and wrote in depth about the mastery of his movies and his distinct style. It was these French critics who were the first to identify Hitchcock as a Catholic filmmaker. They wrote about this in the 60s. Hitchcock himself thought the label was too restrictive, but he did concede that perhaps one's early upbringing influences a person and guides their instincts, such that the Catholicism of his upbringing did come through in his films. And I think this is true of all his films, but there are three in particular that are much more than this. I think they're explicitly Catholic works. And I'll mention the first two, I Confess, about a Catholic priest and the sacramental seal, Vertigo, which has a lot of weird Catholic things happening in it. But the one I want to talk about is The Wrong Man. Anyone seen this movie? Oh, I'm sorry, there are going to be some spoilers. I try not to spoil too much, and what I say, you will still be able to go and watch the movie again and enjoy. So, yeah, write down these movies and go and see them if you haven't seen them. The Wrong Man is a true story. It's the only true story Hitchcock ever made. And in this true story, we can recognize another true story. The truest story we know, and that is the Passion story. It's about an innocent man, Manny Ballesteiro, who suffers the weight of the sins of another and is tortured by a system of injustice. Manny, played by Henry Fonda, walks into a bank and is identified by the bank staff as the man who had previously robbed the same bank. The police come and arrest him, and he's identified similarly by many other people in other places also robbed as the thief. Now, he knows he is innocent, the wrong man. But the number of witnesses speaking against him means his word is not believed. I want to animate one particular sequence for you. And it's in the sequence where Manny is taken to prison. He's at that check-in desk where you have to empty your pockets, take everything out of your jacket and your pants and put it on the desk in a tray, and they seal it up and put it away. And the last thing he takes out is a set of rosary beads. And the guy behind the desk glances up at it and says, "You can keep those." And then later on in the film, we see the court case. And we see this tide of testimony against him. And his face is silenced by this claustrophobia of everyone being against him when he knows he's innocent. And then Hitchcock changes shots, and you see under the table, you see him holding the rosary beads in his hand. And you see this close-up, as things are heating up, of Jesus, of the body on the cross, on the crucifix. Now, all of this says so much about the character and about the film, but it all leads to this scene. I think I have to press a button to enter. Give me a second. I think I'm just going to press.
I'm probably all by myself, though. I've been such an idiot, you'd all be better off without me.
None of it is your fault, Manny. You've just had a lot of bad breaks that can happen to anybody.
Yeah, what can I do?
Have you prayed?
Yes.
What did you pray for?
I prayed for help.
Pray for strength, Manny.
I don't see how anything can help if I don't get some luck. Somebody committed those holdups. Where is he? Maybe in jail already for some other crime in some other state. Maybe, well, he'll never be suspected for anything he committed in our neighborhood.
My son, I beg you to pray.
Gotta go to work.
It's a great transition, eh? And the man we have just seen appear on the screen is going to prove to be pivotal to Manny's prayer. And the way Hitchcock has shown this transition is like grace at work before our eyes. Prayer proves to be the heart of this film about suffering. And Hitchcock relates to us what he understands deeply himself, that God's grace is always at work, especially in the midst of great suffering. So Hitchcock, I think he let his religious practice slide through his career, but he never lost his faith and eventually returned to it in his later years, becoming a daily communicant and eventually dying with reception of the sacraments. A happy end for one of the world's greatest filmmakers. I'd like to briefly now talk about John Ford. He's most famous as the man who made westerns. And John Ford also turned John Wayne into a household name. His films are highly entertaining, action-packed, humorous, just brilliant in every way. He's probably the filmmaker who best portrayed America and its mythology. He made films such as Stagecoach, The Searchers, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, The Quiet Man, The Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, My Darling Clementine, and many more. I'm going to show you a little clip from a film festival which was trying to celebrate John Ford.
In my generation, he was sort of the granddaddy of all directors at that particular time.
Will live forever because his films will live forever. His work is there to inspire and influence this whole new generation of filmmakers.
He is the essence of classical American cinema. And any serious person making films today, whether they know it or not, is affected by Ford.
Some things folks do is nice, some ain't so nice. That's all any man's got a right to say.
Isn't it enough to kill a man without trying to build a life on it?
So like Hitchcock, much has been written on John Ford as a Catholic director. Some have called him the great Catholic poet on the screen. But when you watch his films, you might be tempted to ask, where exactly is the Catholicism inside? In his Irish characters, it's most obvious. and at the times he tells specifically Catholic stories, it's obvious. But in most of his famous films, it's not actually that obvious. Rather, it's through his depiction and celebration of community and ritual as channels of grace that his Catholicism truly emerges. Redemption for Ford never happens alone, but always with and through others. The rituals of communities, which in his films sometimes seem like pleasant distractions, actually have a deeper meaning and purpose. His films shine with a certain optimism, such that even in the darkest films, there are glimmers of light. Now, one example, and you saw a few shots from that sequence we saw just now, there's lots of dances in his movies, community dances, and these can seem irrelevant or unnecessarily light distractions to the storyline. But actually, it is these scenes specifically that we see the community in action. It's here that we see the humanity of the characters and their common journeying toward communion and redemption. Another example, probably politically incorrect today, is the use of violence or brawling as a ritual that leads to peace. His characters must physically beat each other up in order to find true peace in his movies. The ritual is kind of sacramental, the physical expression to get out the inner turmoil and thus be healed from it. We see this in John Ford's most Irish film, The Quiet Man, where John Wayne plays an ex-boxer who has accidentally killed a man in the ring and goes back to Ireland to find some peace and put his whole life behind him. And he swears that he will never fight again. But this brings him into greater conflict with the woman he wants to marry, and especially her antagonistic brother. It's only through fighting the brother in a large brawl does resolution emerge. And the brawl serves as a type of baptism into the community. I'll just show you just 20 seconds from this. So you see there the community in action. It's not just a fist fight. It's a fist fight the whole community is involved in. It's a baptism into the community. I believe the mic's died, so can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? I've got a loud voice, so I'm sure we'll be all right. So before this fight, John Wayne's character is known as the Yank in Ireland. It's only this brawl that wins him, initiates him into the community. And only by community can he find redemption, the redemption he's searching for. So in this film, the American dream and its material success is left behind for the Irish homeland, with its Catholic values, heavy drinking, and public brawling. In other words, a truly Catholic community. Now, Ford was also the filmmaker who made famous Monument Valley. And it features in so many of his films. Is it okay me standing on this side?
No, you're
right. I don't know why I changed. I think closer to this. Anyway.
Might be better there, just so I can get close.
Better there? Oh, I don't know. Sorry. So he had a sacramental use of landscapes. Their sweeping majesty indicated something grand on the pilgrimage that his characters are on. His view was a Catholic view of the world. Life was pilgrimage by which transformation happened. His films contain great sentimentality, but they're also rooted in the real. They are mythic, they are human, they are rich, they are entertaining. Another film, one of his first early famous ones, Stagecoach, and this is the film that made John Wayne famous. It's about a group of random travelers on a stagecoach attacked by Indians and culminating in a shootout. Sounds like a storyline we've heard a million times before. But really what it's about is the motley group of passengers, the sinners and the respectable people. But who's who? The real battle is in the prejudices on board being overcome, rather than the Indians on the outside. And isn't the stagecoach like the church, full of saints and sinners, the humble of heart and the Pharisees? We often think the danger of for us is from the outside, but actually the real danger is the disunity that we can find within. So I'm going to move on now to Frank Capra. Are these films, anyone know these films?
Yes.
Yeah? Good, good. Capra's films were seen as sentimental and patriotic, a celebration of American life and democracy. And they were this, but they were much more. And that was due to his Catholic vision of the world. His focus was on the little people, the innocents who go up against greedy politicians and corporations, who experience defeat, and yet their integrity leads to their ultimate triumph. His films are about the underdog and the dignity of the underdog and the power of goodness to effect change and conversion. The Catholic author Graham Greene described Capra's films as the theme of goodness and simplicity manhandled in a deeply selfish and brutal world. His films were moral films, and even a straight comedy that he adapted called You Can't Take It With You. His comment on it was, it gave him a golden opportunity to dramatize love thy neighbor, and that Christ's spiritual law can be the most powerful sustaining force in anyone's life. So in Capra's films, all his heroes are Christ-like, and they experience crucifixion and ultimately resurrection. Let's take his most famous film as our first example, Jimmy Stewart's It's a Wonderful Life. So George Bailey lives a life of sacrifice for the good of others, but when threatened with the prospect of losing everything, he comes to a crisis and in a moment of prayer calls out, Lord, I'm at the end of my rope. And an angel is sent to show him his life and what it would have been if he had never been born. Now, Capra had this to say about his own film, which actually was a flop when it came out. No one went and saw it. They didn't like it. But this is what he said about it. It's a film to tell the weary, a film to tell the weary, the disheartened and the disillusioned, the wino, the junkie, the prostitute, those behind prison walls and those behind iron curtains, that no man is a failure. To show those born slow of foot or slow of mind, those older sisters condemned to spinsterhood and those older sons condemned to unschooled toil, that each man's life touches so many other lives and that if he isn't around, it would leave an awful hole. What a beautiful comment about the dignity of every human life. Then Mr. Deeds goes to town. Gary Cooper's Mr. Deeds is an innocent, virtuous man wanting to use his $20 million inheritance to help farmers become landowners. But of course, there's people against that plan. He is exploited by newspapers, and his enemies try to have him committed to hospital as being insane. Basically, the point of the film is his Christian virtues make him look crazy. Now, I think all of us in this room understand what that looks like, eh? So this is an unashamedly Catholic director making unashamedly Catholic movies. Movies remembered today as amongst the greatest. One more director I'll briefly talk about. Leo McCarey. This is the man who delivered the figure of the Catholic priest to every American household all over the country through his beautiful film Going My Way. Bing Crosby starred as Father O'Malley, winning an Oscar for Best Actor, and the film itself won Best Picture. Can you imagine today a film winning Best Picture that positively depicts a Catholic priest as the main character? Well, this is 1944. The film had a sequel, The Bells of St. Mary, with Ingrid Bergman as the Mother Superior sister opposite Bing's jazzy priest. Now, they're funny, they're sentimental, they're inspiring. They're just great, wholesome entertainment, and they're iconic for their role in changing the image of the priest. McCarey literally made audiences, Protestant audiences, fall in love with the idea of a Catholic priest, suddenly making him someone you want to invite home for dinner. Then there's his great romance movie, Love Affair, which he remade again a decade later as An Affair to Remember. And just to give my film screenings a plug, we'll be screening this in April an affair to remember. The movie has Cary Grant, it has Deborah Kerr, it has romance, it has comedy, it has tragedy, but in the midst of everything is a key scene that takes place in a chapel, with the two main characters down on their knees in prayer. This moment of prayer becomes the heart of the romance we see unfurl. It's beautiful, it's meaningful, it's Catholic. Now, we've only talked about Hollywood. We're not going to go across the Atlantic to Europe, where there's Rossellini and Bresson, and we could talk about another 20 films, and I could go till midnight. We're not going to talk about all that. Instead, we're going to go to part two of this talk, and that's censorship. Another major influence Catholics had at the cinema was in the area of censorship. The Catholic Church had established their in-house legion of decency, which would rate films according to their morality. Now, Hollywood realized how influential the Church was and appointed a strident Irish Catholic man, Joseph Breen, to enforce what was called the Hays Code, which itself was co-written by a Jesuit priest. And it was the standard by which films needed to be when they were released. Every film needed to meet the standard of the code to get stamped by the PCA, or the Production Code Administration. And if a film didn't get the stamp, it couldn't be screened without facing heavy fines. So the whole making of every movie involved this Catholic man, Breen, and his office. From the writing of the script to its filming, drafts would go to and from the censorship office to ensure that each film was on the right track for being approved. It's unbelievable to contemplate how much power this one Catholic man had in Hollywood. Now, I personally have mixed feelings about all of this. On one hand, I think it wasn't balanced. It was too strict and at times petty and legalistic about what films could or couldn't do. How many classic films have you seen where a married couple sleep in two single beds separated by a side table? Well, many times the office pushed through a change in a script which I've read about and I think it's pretty ridiculous. The word pregnant, for example, was regarded to be inappropriate to be said on screen. So characters said expecting rather than pregnant. And I think the code's eventual decline and overthrow in the 60s and the ensuing spectacle of sex and violence that accompanied it was a direct reaction to the code's prudish nature. The problem with the code and the examples I'm thinking of was the attempt to create a false vision of the world. For example, criminals were never allowed to get away with their crimes in the movies. In these classic movies, if you see somebody do the wrong thing, you know he's not going to get away with it. You know for sure. Sorry, plot spoiler. He gets caught or he dies a tragic death. That's what happens in these films. They always had to be punished. Now, this may reflect a greater eschatological truth, but not so much about the reality of our world today. Why couldn't a film play with this idea of the criminal getting away and ask deeper moral questions in the process? So that's how I feel on one side. And yet, even with its flaws, the code produced rock-solid, amazing movies that made all these directors and writers have to be so creative in their telling of stories. They had to get around things that would be a problem for the code, yet without undermining the story they were trying to tell. And often they succeeded. This made for truly dynamic, inventive, imaginative cinema. As a child, I was able to watch so many of these films, and the adult themes just sailed over my head without my child mind being exposed to explicit adult content. When I watch these films again today, I realize how troubling and adult some of these plot lines are. And I find it magnificent that they can be watched by a variety of audiences, preserving its integrity while also preserving the wholesomeness of childhood. Isn't that a great thing that perhaps we've lost today? Now, directors like Hitchcock got quite cheeky with all of this. In the film North by Northwest, for example, we don't see the leading man and lady consummate their relationship on a train. What we see is them starting to kiss, and one character starts to pull the other character up onto the, you know, that kind of pull-down berth. And then it cuts to a train entering a tunnel. And we're meant to giggle at the symbolic imagery. So part three, where are we now? Now the great directors of the Golden Age, even if they weren't Catholic, they read literature. They knew the great books. They were formed by them. Shakespeare, Homer, Melville, Dostoevsky, as well as the great literature of the Bible. This all shaped their thinking and found its way into their movies, enriching the movies and rooting them in a Christian morality. Their source of entertainment was books, as they were the first filmmakers. There was no film before them. So their creativity and their style was inspired by literature, and it forged the shape of their movies. Then in the 70s came a new wave of filmmakers. And these directors may not have been as well read as the previous generation, but they loved that generation. They loved Hitchcock. They loved John Ford. They loved Orson Welles. So their films are shaped by this vision of the films they grew up on, homaging the classics, yet still one step removed from the literature and the Judeo-Christian roots. I'm talking about Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, William Friedkin. Then came the next wave in the 90s, and these directors grew up watching the films of the previous generation. And again, they were once more removed. So while their storytelling was top-notch and their style breathtaking, their worldview and moral understanding had become skewered. The complete package the original filmmakers had was once again distilled. And we can see that something has been lost, even though these are great storytellers. I'm talking about Quentin Tarantino, James Cameron, Tim Burton. Today, I don't need to tell you how far we've moved away, but there are still a few golden lights in our midst. I want to suggest that Martin Scorsese is one of the greatest Catholic filmmakers we've ever seen. His films are not easy to watch. They're full of violence and unsavory behavior. They don't make for comfortable viewing, and a viewer should be discerning about what they're prudently able to watch. But I want to make an important point here, maybe a controversial point. Catholic movies are not Christian movies. What do I mean by this? Well, I'm criticizing that genre of film known as the Christian movie. To me, little better than a religious Hallmark film. You know the type. God's Not Dead, Courageous, War Room, Fireproof. They're actually under this Christian movie studio. And these films are feel-good movies about faith that usually have stacked decks and superficially painted characters. They're not real. Or, if they are, they're real in a very limited way. And look, if you enjoy those films, then that's fine. Don't worry. I enjoy some dodgy movies myself. But let's call a spade, and admit they're not very good as pieces of art, even if we do enjoy them. Now, Scorsese's films are truly Catholic. It's like comparing the paintings of Thomas Kincaidy to Caravaggio. One is nice looking but kitsch. The other is dark, at times disturbing, but truly beautiful. Scorsese's films are about sin and its wages. In his films, we see meditations on the darkness of humanity. And yet we see a dialogue with faith within. And the suggestion of redemption is possible, even if it seems like it's just out of frame in his films. One of his first films, Mean Streets, has the tagline, "You don't make up for your sins in church, you do it on the streets." And the film asks this question, how do you live holiness in the dirty, corrupt, crime-filled world when you're only in church for 1 hour a week? That's what that film's about. And throughout his career, he's just been obsessed with God and with theology. And sometimes he's got it wrong, but he's wanted to try. His last few films, I think, have especially honed in on faith and the presence of evil and its agents. The Departed, Silence, and The Irishman. With The Irishman, we saw 3 hours of a mafia hitman's life, but it's actually the last 20 minutes set in a nursing home that is what this movie is actually about. And the conversation with the Catholic priest is the climax of the film, with everything previous simply leading to this moment. His most recent film came out this year, Killers of the Flower Moon, again is a meditation on two different kinds of evil. And what is most fascinating is the evil that is evil out of a lack of courage, a lack of conviction, a kind of ascetia, perhaps. Now, Terrence Malick isn't Catholic. I believe he's some sort of Christian, or at least his philosophy is Christian. But his films are what I would call retreat movies. They're movies you watch as if you're entering a retreat. They're challenging to watch because of their non-linear, image-driven style. Tree of Life is about the way of nature and the way of grace. It deals with the problem of human suffering, and it has this grand Book of Job response from God as the heart of the film. So in the movie, a tragedy happens early on, and the characters are trying to come to terms with this tragedy. And all of a sudden, the film just cuts to the Big Bang, and then dinosaurs, and then evolution, and it doesn't explain why. And you're like, what the heck is going on here? But if you know the Book of Job, you know God's response to Job when Job is facing God having suffered so much. And God says, where were you when I created the world? So this movie, without telling us what it's doing, is showing us this thing that we can meditate upon and come to understand deep within ourselves the answer to suffering without spelling it out. His most accessible film would be A Hidden Life, the true life story of Blessed Franz Jagerstätter, a meditation on marriage and a man's conscience, and ultimately a beautiful portrait of a man's soul. It's a beautiful movie. He's a true life saint, a blessed, a saint. And that's a wonderful movie. Again, they're slow movies filled with images of beauty. You don't watch them expecting to see the next Marvel movie. You go in expecting a retreat. You go in expecting a prayerful experience. Now, there's so many I could talk about. The Coen brothers, they're Jewish. They're incredibly biblically literate. And we see this in all their movies in a strong moral framework, no matter how crazy and weird their movies seem on the outside. Again, it's not for the sensitive viewer, but their movies are amazing. We have a couple of Mexican directors, culturally Catholic, and yet even just the culture alone is enough to shape their Catholic-steeped films, such that Catholicism well and truly flows through their movies. Alejandro Iñárritu with Birdman, and especially with The Revenant, and Alfonso Cuarón with Gravity, an explicitly Catholic movie. Now, one of the greatest Catholic films of all time, which I highly recommend for Lent and for Good Friday, is actually made by an atheist, and that's Of Gods and Men. It's about the Trappist martyrs of 1996, and the whole film is rhythmically built around the hours of prayer. It contains one of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen in a movie, to the soundtrack of Swan Lake. It's beautiful. I actually was going to include, I've got it on the slides here, but I don't think I'll have time for it. And my wife said, don't show it. People won't get it unless they've seen the movie. So anyway, but how can an atheist director make such a holy film? Because this is a holy film. And my answer is this: by following the breadcrumbs, by attempting to tell a story and being truthful to that story, then truth emerges gloriously. I want to give you all hope by saying there are actually lots of great directors these days whose films I seek out because they seek to tell the truth. They are truthful to their characters, truthful to the events depicted and their unfolding. And thus we find truth emerge, capital T truth, and Christ's presence is there. They may not be people of faith, but they are making films that reveal truth, beauty, and goodness. And that means that their films can, and with the right discernment and ability to be read, lead people to Christ. If a story is true, then we find the gospel within. And this brings me to the last point I want to make before closing today. There will always be Catholicism at the movies, even if none of the creatives behind the film are Catholic. because ultimately it is our role, those of us in the audience, to bring our Catholicism to the cinema and to each movie we watch. With our vision, we should feel confident to watch and critique films, finding the good, critiquing the bad, and bringing our depth of faith to help us read what is happening here and celebrate where truth is found and where Christ's presence is. As long as there are Catholics, balanced, intelligent, with depth and insight, not afraid of the culture, but ready to engage, being prophets of our time, who can find the word of God even in the most unlikely places, then there will always be Catholicism at the movies. Thank you. That's the end of my talk. If there are questions...
Thanks so much, Jeremy. We will do questions in a moment. Before we do, though, I'm just going to pass these donation buckets around. God Beer, as you know, it's a free event, but to help us defray the costs and to help us to thank our speaker, we just ask people if they're able to make a small donation. We're very grateful. So the buckets will go around. If you can chuck something in and pass it on, that'd be great. Thank you. And yeah, do we have any questions for Jeremy? Go ahead, Arne.
Hi, Jeremy. So movies like Sound of Freedom, which is based on a true story of Tim Ballard trying to rescue children from basically the hells of trafficking. Do you think that's a pro-Catholic movie? Since one of the lines, like when he was asked, why do you rescue children? Because God's children are not for sale. Since it's also not just a Catholic message, but also a very human message, as you just told me before.
Yeah, so I personally haven't seen that movie yet, The Sound of Freedom. I believe it's a very good movie, I've been told. And I believe it's got a very pro-life and Catholic message in that sense. So that's all I can really comment on because I haven't seen it myself. I think it's good that a movie should have kind of challenged the studios and still been released and become a number one hit in spite of the current studio system that does try and squeeze these things out. Even Scorsese's movie Silence, about two Catholic missionaries in Japan, it didn't get a wide release. I mean, it's Martin Scorsese, and it was showing in cinemas for about 2 weeks. It was a film that really lost an audience because Catholics were disturbed by it and didn't want to go see it. And then secular people couldn't understand what this film was about, because who cares if you step on a picture of Jesus? Who cares? So the movie really lost its audience, and yet is probably one of the greatest films I've ever seen in my life. So, anyway, other questions, thoughts?
I wonder if you comment on superhero films, whether they have Catholic merits.
And yeah, sure.
A movie that you had on the screen but you didn't mention, which was Duck Soup.
Yes, okay. So, let me mention Duck Soup first. Duck Soup was directed by Leo McCarey. I'm not going to try and bring out anything Catholic from it. It's a Marx Brothers movie. It's a crazy, wild, out there comedy. But my point in putting it up there was to show the diversity of these filmmakers, especially Leo McCarey, and show that actually us Catholics, we're not uptight, or we shouldn't be uptight. We should be able to make a crazy, out there, you know, comedy and not lose sleep about it. Okay, so that's the Duck Soup comment. Superhero films by their nature have a whole, like it's really, I mean, who's the ultimate superhero? We know, Christ. And the original Superman was meant to be an image of Christ. And when you watch the original 70s Superman directed by Richard Donner with Christopher Reeve, the Christological elements in it are very in your face. It's actually surprising. Marlon Brando plays Superman's father, and there's this dialogue between them about the father and the son, and it's almost like it's straight from the Gospel of John, and you're like, wow, what's going on here? But it's very, very, yeah, in your face again. Look, with all these movies, superhero movies, even Harry Potter, I would say, has a kind of Christological story by the last book. Does that mean it's exactly X equals this? No, that's not what it means. And all these things we have to take, even in the Bible, there are types. David is a type for Christ. Doesn't mean David's perfect. David sleeps with Bathsheba. He does a lot of bad things in the process. But his heart is a heart that stays with God. And all these things he represents is a foreshadowing of what Christ is going to fulfill. So even in the Bible, you know, the analogies don't necessarily follow through all the way. So we shouldn't have to look at these movies and think, oh yeah, but he does something wrong there. So no, that throws out the whole Christ image. No, we've just got to understand how to read literature, how to read film. And definitely in superhero movies, it's pretty strongly there. I would say one of the greatest film trilogies, and I would argue Christian film trilogies, I've seen in recent times, are Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight movies. The three as a whole, all the ebbs and flows and where the character goes, is this great Christian story about crucifixion and resurrection, giving your life for everyone. Anyway.
Cheers. I'm glad you had the quiet man up there because I fell in love with Maureen O'Hara when I was 12. Beautiful. You placed your interpretations of the intent of many of the directors. We had them here now. Do you think they would agree that was their conscious intent in making the movie?
All right, I'll answer this question in three ways. First of all, John Ford was a very disagreeable man, and he refused to answer questions like that. So he'd probably not give you an answer full stop. He'd kind of just fob you off and say, I did what I did, and that's it. There's two possibilities. Either they did consciously plan it to be like that because that's what they lived. They lived community, especially the Irish. They knew community. They knew what it meant. They knew its human ability to uplift, to save. And there was something divine in that. So even without necessarily thinking A, B, C, D, it's instinctually in there to come out. The other thing I'll say is, again, coming back to the idea of the atheist director. If someone is trying to be truthful to story and to characters, they can't help but come out with the truth. And we can recognize that truth, and maybe they didn't consciously think about it, but what they were trying to do is be true to the story. And when they're true to the story, again, truth is a capital T thing. Truth isn't relative. If someone's trying to be true and say, what would this character actually do in this scenario? And what makes sense in our world? What's good about our world? What's not good about our world? These are objective things ultimately. And when someone's being faithful to that, the truth that matches our faith emerges. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's good.
Going my way and the quiet man, the little Irish man in there. And he was
Barry Fitzgerald.
He was good.
Yeah, great actor.
You focused on the directors and how they portray the various elements of Catholicism. Who were the actors that you felt really brought it to the screen, really elevated it? I would say probably the most obvious one would be Jimmy Stewart, particularly in movies such as It's a Wonderful Life, which I've seen countless times and have overanalyzed it. Are there any other actors that you feel really brought out those roles and their presence, if it hadn't been them on screen, would it have suffered? Would it have been different?
Well, look, I mean...
Sorry, Jeremy, you might just want to repeat the question those at the back.
Did everyone at the back hear the question or no? No? So the question was, are there any particular actors that I think really brings out that Catholic spirit and presence in these movies? The example was Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life and a lot of those movies. I'd say there's some people, there's something about them. There's a peacefulness, there's an everyday, everyman quality they have. There's something that's very human about them. So those actors just were able to inhabit those roles wonderfully. Actually, a lot of them were Catholic or ended up being Catholic. Gregory Peck.
John Wayne was baptized 3 days.
Yeah, John Wayne became Catholic, had a deathbed conversion. But again, was very influenced by John Ford and his Catholicism. Yeah. And look, there are some actors who are not Catholic at all, like Montgomery Clift, who lived a crazy type of lifestyle, a very modern type of lifestyle, we'd say. And he plays the priest in Hitchcock's I Confess. And yet, that brokenness, that vulnerability in his life, in the whole old method acting style, people who were broken, brought that brokenness to the screen and allowed that to be used, exploited, however you want to put it, for a greater thing that's happening in the story. Mm-hmm. So the vulnerability of that actor becomes the vulnerability of the Catholic priest in that story, who wasn't a very Catholic guy himself, but, you know? So yeah, perhaps there are some actors who would best do it, Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, Gregory Peck. Mm-hmm. Gregory Peck was a Catholic. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can limit an actor to his faith, really, because again, some amazing actors have not necessarily been the best people and have yet been able to channel something that's grace-filled on screen.
What would you say about the Lord of the Rings movies and Catholicism?
Yeah, look, I didn't mention things like that because I just thought they were too obvious. But Lord of the Rings, I mean, we know Tolkien. Tolkien was Catholic, Catholic, Catholic. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings books are all about Catholicism. You can't get away from it. I remember at Sydney Uni, I'm from Sydney. Sydney Uni, I remember approaching the Lord of the Rings Society and saying, oh, do you want to do a joint event with the Catholic Society? And then being like, no. And I'm like, you guys don't get it. You're all Lord of the Rings fans. You don't get it. Lord of the Rings is Catholic. Anyway, so Peter Jackson, again, trying to be true to the stories as much as he could within the limited time frame he had, a lot of the Catholic themes have to be there. They have to be present, and they come out. So, yeah, they are great Catholic movies because they're based on a great Catholic story. Other questions?
Jeremy, could you just rattle off a few good movies we should all watch?
Oh, well, I'd mention all the ones that I've put up on the screen. Oh, but there are so many. Like, it's just hard to really... have you seen On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando? Yes. That's a great Catholic movie. Catholic because there's actually a Catholic priest in it who's a real hero. Actually, priests in general in those movies were fantastic. Look, I mean, there's so many. Even modern films. You know, I went and saw Ferrari the other day. Earlier this year, Ferrari, and I was blown away by it. I did not expect this movie about cars to find anything that... It's a good director, Michael Mann, a Jewish director, and I thought, oh, I like this director, I'll go see this movie. And I saw Ferrari, and I came out of it thinking, this is one of the most Catholic movies I've seen in a long time. And I'm actually nearly finished writing an essay about it because I was so passionate about what I saw. And I was thinking, oh, how did all these Catholic themes get in there? How did this story about a man and his ego come, like, in this very Catholic way, come into this film? And I did a bit of research, and I saw the scriptwriter who actually died 15 years ago. He had already finished the script, and it took 15 years for this movie to be made. He was a Catholic. He was named after a Catholic priest when he was a child. So I don't know how practicing he was, but something's carried through and has ended up in this screenplay, which then has come into the film. So there's all sorts of things you'd be surprised by. Some of these movies, these modern films that I've mentioned, you might have seen, like The Revenant and Gravity, and not have thought it was Catholic at all. But they are. They're very Catholic. And again, that we can talk specifically about that if you have any questions about that. Feel free to ask me.
Yeah, I've seen Gravity, but where's the Catholicism in Gravity?
In Gravity?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in Gravity, I could talk about the whole story, but I'm going to just hone in on one specific scene where Sandra Bullock's character is alone in space and she's despairing and she's losing hope and she just doesn't know what to do. There's no way out for her. And she starts to have this dialogue with herself. And one of the things she says is, who will pray for me when I'm dead?
who will pray for me when I'm dead? Again, Mexican director, only Catholics pray for the dead. You know, that's explicitly Catholic. Now, I'm just using that one line, but the whole movie is about this person reintegrating herself after this tragedy, and it's almost like she goes on this retreat to be alone and to have this sacrificial act done for her, by which then her eyes are open to a new reality that's based in community, that's based grounded on earth. And that whole movie, we feel this kind of spin out where everything's spinning, and you feel like, you know, finally when earth is there, you feel gravity. And somehow there's a spiritual message coming through that about prayer and about community. Other thoughts, questions? Are we done? I think we're done.
Thanks, everyone. Can we give Jeremy another hand? So I hope you all enjoyed that as much as I do. I've certainly got a few more movies for my movie nights with my wife. And I encourage everyone to grab a flyer for Jeremy's Catholic Cinephiles nights. Flyers are on the table at the front. You can see the details up there. These are really enjoyable nights. Take your husband or wife or boyfriend, girlfriend along for a date. Or just go by yourself. You'll have a great time and you'll get to experience a great, great movie and break it open in a much deeper way.
On the big screen as well, how movies were made to be shown.
Yeah, this is at the Lido Cinema.
Lido Cinemas in Hawthorne. We host these screenings.
Yeah, and I think, like I was saying before, I think you'll develop the skill of analysing films. You can see how good Jeremy is at doing that. He'll help you to break open those films and to see more deeply in them. And I think you'll be able to watch all movies with a greater level of enjoyment and a greater level of insight. So I think that's really wonderful. The next event for God and Beer in March sees John Canavan. John Canavan's going to come and he's going to tell us his story. John's sort of, you know, he's been up on stage here a couple of times, either interviewing people or often getting involved in the Q&A sessions. He's become a bit of a part of God and Beer. But we haven't actually heard his story, and it's a really amazing story. How he went from being a kind of an R-rated stand-up comedian. He was featured on Hey Hey Saturday and in lots of other sort of popular forums, and underwent this really powerful conversion experience. And really, for the last 30 or 40 years, he's been dedicating himself to spreading the gospel around Australia. So it's an amazing story. Come along to God and Beer next month to hear about that. If you aren't already on our email list, please chuck your details down on the table at the door. Father Dean, if you can just put your hand up. Father Dean's just next to the table with the email list. You can also grab a flyer for next month's God and Beer there. If you'd like to take one home to your parish, ask your parish priest if you can put it up in your parish, that would be amazing. Thank you if you can do that. We'd like to thank the Catholic Development Fund for supporting God and Beer. I think there's a slide Andrew will put up on the screen there. The Catholic Development Fund, it's a terrific organisation, and they help a lot of parishes and schools, as well as individuals, with various development initiatives. So we thank them for their support. And finally, the Knights of the Southern Cross, of which God and Beer is an initiative. It's an initiative of the Knights of the Southern Cross. They've got a table set up. Where's our table tonight, Carmen? Carmen is the table. He looks like a man, but he's actually a table. Come and talk to Carmen if you'd like to learn more about the Knights. We'd love to have more men join this fantastic community. And it's a great way to have fellowship and to serve the church and to serve the community. So talk to Carmen if you would like to know more. What am I forgetting, Andrew? Join us on our social media forums. And that's all for tonight. Thanks very much, everyone, and see you next time.